Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
So we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but don't you know
we're
gonna
have a
solar-topia.
We started to burn many things we found. That's the glorious Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Rivertown Kids Solartopia theme song on the Tomorrow's Children, Grammy-winning Tomorrow's Children album. Back again with you, Harvey Wasserman, here for another hour in Solartopia. We got a great show. We got two guests today, starting off with James Otto to talk about a situation at Disney World having to do with immigration and foreign workers and all that stuff. And at 5:30, at halfway through the show, we'll be joined by Stephen Rosenfeld, a co-author that I've worked with Bob Fitrakis over the years, and an editor at Alternet, and we are going to talk about stolen elections, electronic election theft, voting machines, and a major new report come out that gives us pretty serious warning about what could happen in the 2016 election. That's at half past. That's halfway through the show. Mr. Otto, are you with us?
I am. Thank you for inviting me on board.
Okay, tell us a bit about yourself. You've got a major thing going on here with working conditions, employment conditions at Disney, that has a lot to say about the current election campaign, all this yapping about immigration. And, of course, we had today a speech from the Pope, of all people, in the U.S. Congress, talking about immigration, asking people to be a little more, shall we say, liberal about immigration policy, especially in the middle of a huge refugee crisis in Syria. He's talking about the crisis here. But tell us how that all fits in with Disney and their hiring policies.
Okay, well, first you have to understand that there's several different varieties of immigration. You know, what the Pope is talking about and what the political candidates are all talking about is illegal immigration. These are people who come across the border undocumented, you know, undocumented aliens and illegal. Nobody counts them. We're guessing as to the number. But what I'm talking about are foreign workers who are brought into the United States on work visas, and if they enter through the port, you know, ports of entry, and they're counted. Every single foreign worker that enters on a work visa is counted and recorded, and so we know exactly the number of foreign workers we're bringing in to take U.S. jobs, which is completely different from refugees. But where Disney fits
okay, so well, then before you get into this too deep, why don't you explain, James Otto, who you are and what your credentials are and why you're involved with this issue.
Oh, excuse me. You want? I'm an attorney in Northridge, California. I started off life, I like to think, as a Marine Corps officer, and I served in the United States Marine Corps for about 4.5 years. Went overseas, had a trading company in the Far East, came back to the United States, and went to law school. And I've been an attorney for just over 30 years.
And what did you do in the Marine Corps? When you were in the Marines, what did you do?
Well, I was what we call a combat engineer officer. If you remember any of the John Wayne movies, World War II movies about hitting the beach, I was in the landing support battalion, which means they're the first off those landing crafts onto the beach and begin to set up the beach for everybody else who comes behind us. But fortunately, or unfortunately, I guess fortunately for me, we had no amphibious assaults during between 1976 and 1980 when I served. But that's what I did in the Marine Corps. I prepared.
One of the few times in U.S. history where we actually—I don't think we invaded anybody, did we? Those were the Carter years.
Yeah, those were the Carter years. We didn't invade anybody. So,
It's like being on vacation. Amazing. And so now you're an attorney, and I'm interested in part because I just watched a major documentary on Walt Disney. It's on PBS. And, you know, he was really a mixed bag when it came to, and especially now with employment issues. So tell us about why you're so concerned about foreign workers in the Disney empire.
Well, Disney is just the tip of the iceberg. It's illustrative of what's going on all across this country. And at Disney, corporate bosses made the decision not to employ any more American workers, any more U.S. workers, at least as far as the IT department. But they have shown signs, and only signs, of removing U.S. workers in other areas. I sued a number of large corporations, Fortune 500 corporations, and they don't limit themselves just to IT. They usually spread foreign immigrants all across, you know, the range of jobs they have. But at Disney, specifically at Disney, what they did was they brought in about 850 foreign workers to replace the U.S. workers. But the people they bring in are unskilled. The foreign workers are unskilled. And so Disney forced the qualified, highly skilled U.S. workers to train their own replacements, these unskilled foreign workers. And if the U.S. workers said no, if the American workers said no, I don't want to train them, then they were fired immediately. And so they didn't get paid. So it was kind of like, you know, if you hung around and trained these guys, at least you had the chance to go out and look for jobs.
Well, where are these workers working in the Disney empire? Are they at Disney World, Disneyland? Where?
Actually, they laid off about just around 600 in Disney World in Orlando, Florida, and another 250 or more in Disneyland here in Anaheim, California. Plus, Disney was going to lay off about 150 U.S. workers from their ABC studios in both Burbank, California, and New York. Either my client's lawsuit or the New York Times article that came out in June of this year persuaded Disney otherwise, and they called off the job terminations.
So you're saying that Disney has made a conscious decision to not have American workers, U.S. citizens, work for them, and they're using all foreign workers now?
Yes, yeah. In order to get these worker visas, and specifically H-1B visas, that seems to be the acronym that's most used in the press these days, but to get a foreign worker imported begins with the U.S. corporation. The U.S. corporation has to say, I don't want to hire American workers, I want to import them from overseas, because there are plenty of U.S. workers in the United States. I mean, all the numbers, anywhere you look, say there are plenty of workers. But the U.S. corporation decides it does not want to hire a U.S. worker, fills out what is known as an LCA application, which is a request to the Department of Labor to certify that they may bring over X number of foreign workers. That form does not say anything about why they need them or how much. Well, it does say that they're going to pay them at least $60,000 a year, which is never true. But what happens is the Secretary of Labor is forced to sign that. By statute, she cannot, the Secretary of Labor cannot investigate the veracity of the application. So it's rubber stamped. And then the approved application is then sent overseas to a staffing company who hires some foreign worker and gives them the visa. Then the foreign worker goes into the U.S. embassy with his passport and a visa application, approved visa application, and gets a worker visa, which allows that worker to immigrate or to come to the United States to take a job. So you see, the visa is for a specific job in the United States. The foreign worker does not come over here looking for a job. He has a job in hand already because the U.S. corporation has decided not to hire Americans. And so how does that play out in Disney? So Disney had to go overseas to obtain these foreign workers. Once they were obtained, then they fire the U.S. workers, but they offer the U.S. workers continued employment as long as they train the unskilled foreign import. And that's the scheme. That has worked for the last decade or so, and has actually replaced just about 60 million U.S. workers.
60 million?
Oh, yeah. Those are the numbers from this Department of State. Department of State issues the visas, so they count how many visas they issue, which is just 59,900,000. So I say approximately 60 million. Then you go to the Department of Homeland Security, which is in charge of the ports of entry on our border. And again, because there's a visa, they come through the turnstile, right? And everyone is counted. Every visa is counted. Every reason for entry is counted. And so Department of Homeland Security issues an yearbook every 2 or 3 years. And we know exactly how many visas were issued, how many visas entered the country. And you compare the two, and lo and behold, they're identical. Okay. So we know that of the 60 million visas issued by the State Department, they were all used to enter this country, because we know that because they're counted at by the Department of Homeland Security. So, yes, 60 million foreign workers came in.
60 million foreign workers get worker visas every year into the United States?
Excuse me. I misspoke, okay? In the last 7 years, 60 million workers have come in. Excuse me. That was my fault. Actually, in the last 3 years, we've imported over 9 million foreign workers each year.
9 million a year come in on visas just to work in the United States.
Correct. That's the numbers according to the...
And these are one-year visas.
No, they're three-year visas. So you come across on these worker visas, you're allowed to stay in the United States for 3 years. But then all you have to do is send in a paper application, and it gets extended for another 3 years. So you could stay 6 years. But at year five, you get your green card. And so now you're a permanent resident. You stay permanently.
Amazing. So now you're saying, well, first of all, you mentioned that you have a plaintiff. What is the lawsuit that you're involved with on Disney?
Well, the lawsuit is alleging that besides the national origin, there's national origin discrimination, which is that employers may not make any type of employment decision based on a preference for or against one specific nationality, national origin. And in this case, as in many, many cases, the U.S. employer chooses specifically to hire from a specific national origin, from a specific country. For example, in Disney's case, they used what we call a body shop. The name is Cognizant Technology Solutions, Inc. Cognizant states that it only recruits young male Indians from India to be imported into the United States to replace U.S. workers.
That's a dot as opposed to feather. Sorry.
Say again?
Okay. People from India. And so, now how many workers are we talking about?
Again, at Disney, in the last 12 months, they wanted to replace 1,000. They ended up replacing 850. But how many people are we talking about? Well, about 9 million a year. You know, the Bureau of Labor Statistics publishes a number of job openings. The number of paid wage jobs was about 157 million. The number of approximate number of open jobs per year, which is about 2.7 million. So if you were to say the first 2.7 million imported foreign workers occupied empty jobs, then the math would be about 6.3 million imported foreign workers replaced jobs that were occupied by qualified U.S. workers. So,
and how many talk about at Disney?
Well, at Disney, like I said, last 12 months, about 850 were replaced.
And what is the nature of your lawsuit?
Well, the nature of the lawsuit says that besides the national origin discrimination, because Disney wanted to hire only from a national origin, but they also did it in a very horrendous and troubling way. They brought in a high-ranking executive, not just a local manager or director, but they went and got some senior executive vice president to come down to talk to these workers, American workers. And after he told them that they were going to be let go, but they had to train the foreign replacements, there were some protests. And he got upset, and he told the American workers, he said, well, you better get used to it, because you're going to have to learn how to wear a sari, which is Indian dress, and speak Hindi, which is an Indian language, because that's the only place you're going to be able to find a job. So so Disney's attitude, corporate attitude, is very hostile to U.S. workers. But it's about the same wherever you go. You know, Bank of America has replaced a lot of workers. Xerox, you know, has replaced about tens of thousands of workers. Of course, HP, when Carly Simon was around, replaced approximately 30,000 U.S. workers. All of them imported foreign labor to replace qualified Americans.
And so what is the substance of your lawsuit? What are you trying to get legally here?
Oh, well, when a U.S. worker, when any employee is wrongfully terminated or terminated for wrongful reasons, they're entitled to their job back. They're entitled to back pay and benefits. They're entitled to, and of course, if the employer doesn't want to have them back, the employer can buy them out, which is called front pay, which is usually about 20 years of front pay. So all I'm trying to do is get these workers who have been harmed by illegal conduct, like at Disney. I just want them, and the law wants them, the public policy is to make them whole again, to rectify any harm caused by the wrongful decision to exclude American workers from the workforce. So that's what we're doing with this particular lawsuit. I've got other major lawsuits against, for example, Molina Healthcare, which did the same thing but in much greater numbers, and in fact is still doing it. That case is worth, in my estimation, it's probably worth around $300 to $500 million, and that'll be going to trial next year. Each case is, valued on its own and depends on the number of people, et cetera. But Disney is just like I said, just the tip of the iceberg. It's illustrative of how corporate America views American workers. They're just dispendable. I mean, and it's not even not we use them up. We just steal their knowledge. In fact, Disney had an interesting term for this training. They called it knowledge transfer. And I know this because I've gotten the executive handbook on the transfers and what they wanted to do with it. So Disney called it a knowledge transfer when the qualified U.S. worker has to teach the unqualified foreign import how to do the job, which is also interesting from the viewpoint that on these H-1B visas or any worker visa, the importing company, the importing employer has to verify that these imported workers are highly skilled and experienced. Well, of course they're not. They hire them off the streets of wherever overseas, and they have no education and no training, and they get trained by the U.S. worker who's getting replaced, and that's and that's been the reality for a long time. So
amazing. So the great American enterprise here, the ultimate American business, Walt Disney, is going to have totally staffed by foreign workers?
Eventually, yes. Eventually. The numbers are very disturbing. Again, you look at from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, we know that there are approximately 157 million paid jobs in the United States on any particular year. And because we could also fairly pin down the number of H-1Bs still working in this country to be just about 60 million, that's approximately 38% of our workforce. And if you take a look at the growth of imported H-1Bs, imported foreign workers, it's easy to see and quite mathematically easy to calculate that within 10 years, there will be over 100 million imported foreign workers in the United States during any seven-year period, which means that they will be occupying well over 66% of all available jobs in the United States.
What's the wage difference between what a foreign imported worker will work for as opposed to an American worker?
Well, it's close to 70% difference. So the workers in my clients, for example, whether they're in Long Beach, California, or Anaheim, or Burbank, or Orlando, Florida, you know, they're being paid between, say, $60,000 to $100,000, depending on their job duties. But the foreign worker is being paid somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000, even though the U.S. company that imports these workers has to verify to the Department of Labor that they're being paid in excess of $60,000. You know, the reality is they're getting paid maybe top dollar, $30,000 to $35,000.
So how do they get around the reporting requirement?
Oh, they just lie, and nobody checks up on them. You know, I mean, for example, what was it, about 18 months ago, we had that case down around, I believe it was Alabama, a gentleman named Jay Palmer worked for a body company, one of these importing companies called Infosys, and his job was to create fraudulent letters inviting Infosys employees from India to come into the United States to attend some fake conference. And this was done on what is known as a B-1 visa. And B-1, you know, allows for business visitors to come in for short term, not to do any substantive work, but more for education. You know, you come to a conference and you sit through all those classes or something like that. Well, Mr. Palmer claims, and he said so under oath, that at Infosys he was generating something like 30,000 letters a year, you know, to invite these workers over to fake conferences. There was no conference. And once these imported workers came over, then they would do substantive jobs. And they would stay for the full length of the visa, which is approximately, in a B-1, is just about 1 year, but it could be extended up to 3 years. And so they would stay the full length of the visa, 3 years, doing substantive jobs, which is, of course, a felony. But when this came out and Congress had an investigation, well, Infosys ended up paying $54 million penalty, but there was no criminal prosecution, which is very interesting since the penalty is, you know, for a crime. And but our government decided that they would let them go and not seek criminal charges against Infosys, which is the number two importing body shop right now in the United States.
Fascinating. We're talking with James Otto, an attorney from Southern California, involved in a major lawsuit against the Disney company for using imported foreign workers to undercut American workers. And I am not a big, I'm a proponent of immigration, but this sounds like a total scam to me. Huh. What court are you in? Are you in federal court?
No, I use, out here in California, I use California state courts because the state law, our California state law provides greater protection for the worker than does the federal law. The federal law does a good job, but again, California legislature has added on certain protections. So it's more advantageous to my California clients to use California state law. So,
Are you suing Disney as a corporation? Are you suing any individuals at Disney?
No, I'm suing the corporation only because under our California law, which is known as the Fair Employment and Housing Law, I cannot sue an individual employee like this executive, you know, unless he does something personally, like harassment. You know, in sexual harassment cases, you could sue the individual employee, but in this type of situation, I'm not allowed to. So I am just suing the Disney Corporation, who is responsible for the acts of all of its employees. So,
and how much money are you asking for?
Well, that's to be determined because by the, I would anticipate that Disney is going to fight this and throw everything they have at it because their importing company, their body shop, if you will, is Cognizant Technology. And I'm also suing for other clients, for different clients. I'm suing Cognizant and Molina Healthcare in Long Beach, California. And they've thrown four major law firms at me. So it's like 24 attorneys to one. But that's okay. I know the law, so and I've got the facts and I've got the witnesses. So we'll go to trial with that one. But I would anticipate Disney does the same thing and Cognizant does the same thing. And so it might be a while before it gets to trial, but ultimately it will get to trial. And we will have the witnesses and the documents to prove what the complaint alleges. So, because I have them already.
Are you saying that we're going to go to Disneyland in Anaheim or Disney World in Orlando, and all the workers there are going to be from India?
Well, you're not. If you went there today, you're not going to see that. You'll see a lot of Indian faces, but what in this particular case, I would say yes. If you went back behind the scenes to the IT department, to the computer rooms, you would see only Indian faces. Okay. Many, many publications have interviewed some of these folks from, say, Florida, from Disney World, and these laid off workers. They said, you know, Disney imported so many foreign workers that you didn't hear English anymore. It was rare to hear anybody speak English. It was all Indian, Hindi, you know, and you know, you thought you were in a foreign land. At work, when you're working in the IT department, you thought you were in a foreign country, which is exactly the same thing that happened here in Long Beach, California. They brought in, or Molina Healthcare brought in so many foreign workers that they literally changed the cafeteria food from, you know, California style, which is Mexican and you know, hamburgers and hot dogs and a few other things, you know. But it all became Indian fare, and it was nicknamed Little Mumbai, because that's all you heard was Hindi, Indian spoken, even in meetings, management meetings, personal contacts. It was all in Hindi, which...
Amazing, amazing. Yeah. So where can we see about this? Have you posted any articles? Anything been written about this lawsuit?
I posted, well, my website is Law Offices, that's with an S, Law Offices of JamesAAuto.com. Make sure you remember the S, because if you just put in Law Office, you're going to get my prior website, which was hacked as soon as I started this recent round of lawsuits.
Has anybody actually written about an article about this lawsuit?
About Disney lawsuit?
Yeah, about yeah. Your lawsuit there. Is there anything published about this situation?
I believe there is. I've given several interviews. I think there have been some either websites or bloggers who have written about the Disney situation. The Molina case was covered by press all over the world, from India to Zurich, Germany. Has, you know, there have been periodicals that have published the Molina case. So on my website I have a number of articles that I've written about, to give you background as to what is happening with the visa situation, how it's a scam, how, you know, Government Accountability Office has done several investigations. I've provided links to the last one, you know, where the GAO concludes that the visa fraud's abundant. This, you know, the abuse of fraud is just everywhere. You know, I've quoted... what's his name? Chuck Grassley, Senator Grassley, and Senator Dick Durbin, who have done congressional investigations, and they conclude, you know, the whole visa program is rife with fraud and abuse. You know, and I'm writing an article, an interesting article. Well, I think it's interesting. It's not quite yet done, but on the issue of spies. Apparently, according to the FBI reports, which began about 10 years ago and continued to today, there are more foreign spies in the United States than there are FBI agents, and they all come across on what is known as the F-1 visa, student visas. So foreigners use the student visa to come into the United States. They go to school. As soon as they get to school, Congress has created a job preference program for them, which creates a lot of incentive for U.S. employers to hire these foreign students, which happens within their first year. They convert, they change their status from student to an H-1B, then they go to work for some high-tech company. They rise up through the ranks, and they start sending top-secret, you know, software and codes back to China. In fact, I think it was 2007, the FBI arrested a number four person at NASA because she was doing exactly that. She was sending all these top secret information, weapons, about weapons, U.S. weapons systems, back to the Chinese Navy. And, you know, the FBI also says that, you know, especially if you're a professor who teaches, you know, high tech type of stuff, whether it's hardware or software, be very careful about the particular students, because it's known that they've been sending back codes, you know, the computer codes for various companies. Now, I haven't quite been able to place, you know, a Chinese spy on the hacking job, you know, at the Pentagon or even Ashley Madison, for that matter. But they, you know, the Chinese clearly hacked into the computers in the Pentagon and at Sony and various other companies. But and so it's easy to see how we are educating these current spies, and these spies then send information back to the Chinese military, who then uses it to hack into American systems. So,
all right. Well, we've been talking with James Otto, an attorney in Southern California, about an amazing situation I hadn't heard of. Does Disney, when they bring in these, the final question, when Disney brings in these workers from India, do they find places for them to live, or do they just pay them a salary and let them scramble around?
You know, I don't know specifically about Disney. I know in other companies, they're told, they're given housing, they're introduced to other foreign workers, and they typically live anywhere from 10 to 15 in an apartment. So, because they're not making that much money, and most of them, you know, they come here to send money home, and so they really need a place to live cheaply. And so they tend to accumulate, you know, in large numbers in small apartments. So, but
amazing, amazing. Well, thank you so much. That's something I didn't know about, hadn't heard about. We're going to take a short break, and Steve Rosenfeld will be back with us to talk about election theft after a couple minutes here. James Otto, thank you very much. Good luck with your lawsuit, and keep us posted. And we'll be looking for the Indian food at Disney World in the coming years. Okay? Thank you very much. You take
Thanks
care.
Again. Bye-bye.
We'll be back in 3 minutes with Steve Rosenfeld.
Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, I'm Sandy Leon Best, host of Political Analysis. Welcome to the 21st century, where the corporate propaganda machine works 24/7 to manufacture your reality. Every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, Political Analysis challenges the corporate narrative with independent news, analysis, and passionate conversations on the most critical issues of our time. Don't let the corporate echo machine become your truth. Tune in live to Political Analysis or visit the archives at PRN.FM. If you like the show, rate us in iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Have you ever listened to Anthony Robbins, watched the movie called The Secret, or read about the power of positive thinking from the perspective of any of the many fine authors who have written about the subject? They all focus on the law of attraction, which governs every second of every life of every person in the universe. Like attracts like, and everything you do, feel, and think about as a regular way of being determines your life experiences. PRN's new show, LOA Today, explores all aspects of this magnificent law of the universe every Thursday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. Join hosts Walt Thiessen and Ioana June Thiessen as we explore the law of attraction each week. That's LOA Today, Thursday evenings from 7 to 8 p.m. here on PRN.
Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
Oh, hi, Andy. How are you? Good, good. I gotta get back. I'm on the phone.
Was there an Eve, or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Yeah, we had to pay the cost. That was the beautiful Donna Williams singing with Pete Seeger again. Our break is done. Steve Rosenfeld, are you with us?
Yeah, hey, nice to be here.
Good, good to have you on. Okay, we're honored with the presence of Steve Rosenfeld. Steve, what's your title at Alternet?
Oh, gosh.
Okay, Steve is the oh, gosh at Alternet.
Yeah, I guess I'm their national political reporter, and I edit things, too, and, it's, you know, things are a little blurry sometimes in the job category.
Yes, well, that's like being asked if you're at Woodstock. You know, the answer is, well, I don't remember. So, Steve, you and I and Bob Patrakis and a ridiculously tiny handful of people have done a lot of writing about election theft and election protection. And you have just published a major piece at Alternet about a recent report from the Brennan Center on, you know, the state of our electronic voting machines. Can you talk to us a bit about it?
Sure. Well, yeah. Well, the Brennan Center basically said that a vast majority of the counties in America where people are going to be voting in 2016 for president have voting machines that are on the verge of breaking down, seriously breaking down. And they're liable to do this, and this includes Ohio, in many different ways, because basically the heart of these machines are computers that are more than 10 or a dozen years old. Their operating systems are even older than that. And many of the interfaces, like the touch screens where votes are to be cast and correctly assigned, and is the alignment is off, the electronic components have degraded, and the memory systems, whether it's the motherboards that operate these machines or some of the memory cards that are also used, are also old and vulnerable. It's just like somebody pulling out an old, PC that's in a file cabinet for the last 10 years to find an old address and waiting 2 minutes for it to boot up and hoping everything's going to work, and it just moves at the speed of molasses. And the security systems are almost, well, they're just babyish compared to what people do today can use today. You know, the Wi-Fi is easily accessible. But the biggest problems, they said, are not the notion of things being stolen, because, you know, a mainstream organization like Brennan doesn't want to talk about election theft. But they are very happy to talk about how they are at this state of, you know, very vulnerable disrepair to try to make the case that something must be done. And, of course, nothing's going to be done until there's a big crisis, which means after an election.
Well, the problem is, of course, with electronic voting theft, is that we can have a big crisis and not know it, for God's sakes. Tell us a bit real quickly, Steve, who exactly is the Brennan Center and
their
function?
Well, the Brennan Center at NYU, the Brennan Center is a creature of NYU, New York University Law School. And it was founded by activist attorneys who are generally liberal. They generally believe in voting rights. They get involved in a lot of election litigation, meaning they will help activists all across the country file suits on challenging new voter ID laws, challenging all kinds of things that might try to gum up voter registration or early voting or somehow suppress the turnout. And they have other areas too, but they're very big. They have a very big democracy program. And some of the people who are the head of it are, they're big shots in the legal world. They used to run the ACLU. They've now tried to tell the ACLU they got to change their position on money and politics and regulating campaign contributions. And so they're a big deal. I would say they and Pew Charitable Trust, their Pew States Center on the States, are the two biggest players outside of government that are really trying to shape, election policy from the more sort of liberal left.
Right. Now, Pew is P-E-W.
For example, not to digress too much, Pew is pretty much under the radar, gone into states and helped them all but automate voter registration information and so that they can then contact eligible voters. They've done this for almost 15 million people. Nope, and the Republicans have not seemed to take notice, which is pretty good. And so Brennan puts out this report, and it's not the first time that they've done this. And the thing about this is, you know, where this conversation can go is, you know, Harvey, you have, you know, you and Bob have gone back to, you know, it goes back before, you know, George W. and the Republicans did everything they could to steal the vote in Ohio in 2004. It actually goes back to Florida in 2000, where we had this, you know, your listeners will probably remember. Remember hanging chads? What's that? Oh, yeah, those computer punch cards that didn't get counted. Oh, yeah, the butterfly ballots where all these elderly Jews in outside Miami were voting for Pat Buchanan because the ballot design was so screwy. Oh, yeah, Greg Palast found his, you know, got, you know, did some investigative reporting and found that, you know, the state had purged tens of thousands of legal voters because they shared the names of felons or similar birth dates. And they knew it was wrong, but, hey, they didn't care because those were people who would probably get a vote Democratic. So out of that mess of Florida came Congress in 2002 passing a law with several billion dollars to buy a new generation of voting machines. Well, those are the voting machines that you know, we and others have been warning about for years. And now they're on the verge of breaking down.
So you're saying that the machines that the Brennan Center talked about are machines that were bought with money from the Help America Vote Act that was passed in 2002, and
exactly.
So that would make them now 13 years old.
Yes, exactly.
12, 13 years old.
Exactly. So what we're talking about here is, you know, election officials have known about this for a long time, and I think it's really sometimes important to separate, like the civil servants, you know, from the people who are, like, you know, in the legislature appropriating money and writing all these laws. A lot of the election officials who are managing county elections know they have a mess on their hands, but what happened going back, they're kind of embarrassed because if you go back like after 2002, you know this is a backwater area of government, so they got lobbied by all these voting machine companies who they made all these over promises. Oh, we have the latest and the greatest technology. It will be fantastic. It will help the disabled community. It will be touch screens. It will be no more messy paper. You know, forget paper. You know, it'll be automatically, you know, added up and then sent in by Wi-Fi or by modem, and then it'll be tabulated, and it will just be no problem whatsoever. And that's not exactly how it worked out. You know, I'm sure you don't have to be told this. I mean, you know, but anyway, in the intervening years, a lot of local election officials have realized, okay, this machine has a problem with, like, you know, the vote flips. You press a Democratic, it registers Republican, or vice versa. They figured out how to deal with that. Or they figured out, oh, we got to get these memory cards to sort of work better. They have figured this out. But now the actual infrastructure, the computers themselves, are just getting to be too old, and there's no replacement in sight.
That's astounding. You know, here we haven't even gotten the public in the United States to pay attention to the fact that the 2000 and 2004 elections were stolen. And in the middle of all that, the government in 2002 and 3, based on a bill promoted by a guy who went to prison, for God's sakes, so they spent, God knows what, you may know, I don't know, more than $1 billion.
It was several billion dollars. Yeah.
Several billion dollars to put in voting machines across the country because there were hanging chads in Florida. And now, before the public has even come to terms with the fact of what happened, the machines that were purchased are obsolete. That's really mind-boggling.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's even more outrageous than that because, you know, let's just, like, remind your listeners. I'm sure nobody needs to be reminded that they've heard all kinds of noise from Republicans that the voting process needs to be policed. They just go on and on and on about election fraud, which they define as voter impersonation fraud, which means that somebody is going to go in and vote more than once. And yet it happens maybe like, once in a million or once in a 10 million times, and it's usually like the first cousin of somebody who's running for sheriff. And so they, in the meantime,
right.
they've imposed restrictions on millions of people. You know, they passed laws. So in Ohio, what is that? You know, they like 10 million voters statewide or more than that. You know, and
it's about there's 11 million people in the state of Ohio.
It's about five to five and a half million
yeah. voters.
Okay. So 5.5 million people get punished because there's a phantom menace. Okay, and because you know their whole ability to have a fast, efficient, expedient, accurate, you know, casting a ballot is, you know, it gets impeded, it gets derailed, it gets slowed down, it gets interrupted. But, and that's like, and you hear that story, state after state, state after state. Okay, here's the reality. We're just talking purely of scale. What are people reacting to, overreacting to, underreacting to? According to this Brennan report, they said, where do I have it here? It's something, the equipment that needs to be replaced represents approximately 40 million registered voters, and their states total 387 out of 538 electoral votes, and no one's talking about it. I mean, the Brennan people are talking about it, but nobody in Congress. Well, the Democrats would like to talk about it, but, I mean, in the House, nothing's...
No, they don't have the... I mean, you know, we still have not had, and you're very familiar with this, we still have not had any acknowledgement from either Al Gore or John Kerry that there was anything out of whack in the two elections that they won and then had stolen from them. It's mind-boggling. We're talking to Steve Rosenfeld here of the Alternet, has a wonderful piece up about the Brennan Center report on the obsolete machines that are going to be deciding really the electronic vote tabulation in 2016. And, you know, there's all this speculation, who will it be and can Hillary win? She can't win.
The only way that she can, look, what I've seen, you know, we wrote a book about the 2004 election. God,
right.
So long ago. You know, now we're talking about 2016. The only thing that I've seen in all these intervening years is that the only way you can be sure to win an election is to win by a large margin, which is to have a strong enough turnout that all these little injuries, you know, these microaggressions against the democratic process that have been written and designed by partisan Republicans, basically don't dent it enough to keep your candidate below the 50% plus one mark. And that's the only thing. And, yeah, with a candidate who is not exactly generating a lot of enthusiasm, I mean, I don't know whose people are less enthusiastic about, you know, Jeb Bush or Hillary Clinton.
yeah, right. They should run together, you know. I mean, one should be president, one should be vice president. It'd be like Adams and Jefferson back in 1796, you know. I mean, it's ridiculous. She is not going to, you know, our belief is, and I'm sure you share at least a part of this, that Obama was able to, well, it's basically the theme. Obama was able to win and to overcome election theft in 2008 because he won by more than 10 million votes.
That's
now
exactly
the official
right.
vote count. Yeah, the official vote count came in around 7, but
yeah.
Some of us, you know, in our little here cult of election electronic voting reportage, believe he won by as much as 15 million. You know,
yeah. And that's the whole point. It can't be by a little. It's got to be by a lot. You know, and this notion that the machinery is just so screwed up. And, I mean, look, this, I actually know and have, like, talked to some of the people that are quoted in this report, or I've met them. I mean, the Ohio Secretary of State, John Husted, basically says, next time we go to the polls to elect a president, these machines will be 12 years old. That's a lifetime when it comes to technology. You know, the guy who's the head of, in near Kansas City, Missouri, basically says, you know, we don't want to be another Florida. This is the kind of stuff. There's the guy who runs the, you know, Orange County, California. He's been going out there and trying to buy stuff on eBay military surplus to actually patch the machines. And this is the kind of stuff that's really going on. And they're thinking that, and Brennan is applauding this as proactive, responsible, stewardship.
God, that's hilarious. So what you're saying, why didn't they just go to the Salvation Army? I mean, you're saying that they're trying to these voting precincts that have to conduct the 2016 election, which will decide the fate of the earth. They're going out on eBay to buy electronic voting equipment.
Yeah,
is that right.
Neil Kelly, the registrar in Orange County, and I've met him. He's a solid guy. He's not a flake. So his proactive approach was, he replaced the cable connections on 11,000 machines with military-grade hardware. USA Today wrote about this. And then he's, buying other machines to cannibalize the parts. And there's, now, in Virginia, which is one of the swing states, I mean, they just decommissioned the machine because they figured out that you could easily hack into it and change the totals, and no one would know the difference. And and they're also talking about how the modem equipment to send in the results, it's so slow and so old, they don't even know where to get it. Or another county was talking about, the memory cards are in kilobytes, not megabytes or gigabytes. I mean, this would be funny if it wasn't serious.
Oh, my God. And obviously this stuff is so eminently hackable that, we wrote in somewhere around 2007, 2008, that, well, earlier in 2004, that you could actually drive by some of these voting machines and flip the result by Wi-Fi.
Yes,
I assume that's still the
case.
They
discovered this in Virginia after 2014, and they took those machines off it. Now, the thing about this is, the book we did about what happened in Ohio actually got noticed by the Democratic National Committee and the Democratic, the Obama campaign. And what they learned from our book and what they ended up doing was they ended up tracking the contractors who maintained the machines so that if they started seeing some funny business, they basically could quarantine that company's service area, and that was the impact of our book on the Obama elections.
Oh my God! It hadn't occurred to me before I read your article that obsolescence was another problem. I mean, we have been working on the assumption since 2000 that the whole but especially since 2004. 2000 was an instance where it all focused on one state. And, there was some problem with the electronic voting machines in Volusia County, which did give the media, Fox, an excuse to flip the momentum of the reporting on the election. But electronic voting machines were not the predominant issue in 2000. And then in 2004... they were clearly the issue in Ohio and New Mexico and maybe other states we didn't really know about. But after 2004 and after the HAVA money came in and they switched the whole system to electronic voting machines, I mean, our estimate, and maybe you can corroborate, is about 80% of the vote in the United States will be cast on electronic voting machines in 2016. Is that a number that you work with?
I'm not sure what the current number is. Yeah, I mean, I know where to get it. I know the people who do it. But, it's clearly more than 50%. And one of the things is some states have entirely paperless systems, swing states, like Virginia. And, Virginia is one of those states where, it's got those strange politics. It's purple on some days and blue on others and red on others. And, and so there's no audit possibility. Not that there's ever time to do a recount anyway. In other places, like out here in California where I am, people thought they were smarter because they have the hand-marked paper ballots that are then put through optical scanners. because they say, okay, well, at least you have a paper record and you can have a recount. And that is true. You know, when Al Franken was challenged, you know, when he was running for U.S. Senate, the recount came down to examining it one by one by this board that Scott Walker is trying to destroy right now, now that he's not running for president. But anyway, the thing is, the optical scanners are also, you know, they are also breaking down. So, and this is not from me. This is from the Brennan Center. This is, you know, the Brennan Center. You know, they're a big deal in the election law world. They are not, you know, wide-eyed conspiracy theorists. In fact, their report really doesn't talk about hacking at all because they don't want that part of it to be. They say, yeah, they had to take stuff off the market in Virginia and decommission machines because, like you said, you could drive by and if you knew what you were doing, you know, you could change the results via Wi-Fi. But who really has that kind of knowledge? You know.
Well, you do, and you know what, Steve? We're almost out of time. If you can come back next week, I'd like to have you on the top of the hour, and I'll see if I can get Bob. This stuff is we haven't even scratched the surface here. And you have a book. Very quickly, how do people get a hold of you? What's the title of your book?
Oh gosh, well, I mean, I don't have like a current book. I've got something coming out in Europe in a month or so, but that's a whole other story. It's not even on election topics. But I'm on the internet, and you know, and I'm like their national political reporter, and you know, most of the pieces are analysis or commentary type pieces, and if anyone wants to get a hold of me, it's just steven@alternet.org. And
we will do that. Steve, if you can come back next week, I'll see if I can get Bob. We need to talk about this some more. It's staggering.
Need to talk about it, Harvey, because there's a good chance that the Republican ticket's going to have someone from Ohio and someone from Florida. I'm not sure what the exact combination is, but...
I think we're seriously screwed. I think, frankly, to sign off on this, the only way that the Democrats win in 2016 is if Trump runs as a third-party candidate, and if the Republicans let him live. the hammer is going to come down on Donald Trump. I mean, he's already feuding with Fox, and he is going to have to decide if he's going to run independent or if he doesn't. And if and I don't see the Republicans nominating anybody else but Jeb Bush. Frankly, it doesn't matter where he is in the polls right now, and they will not nominate Donald Trump.
Well,
he's too much of a weak
candidate. There are only two people who know what a president does on that ticket, and it's Bush and it's your governor. Everybody else, Kasich, that's what John Dean wrote in a column, you know, last week.
Right. So I think, Steve, if you'll come back next week, if you can make it, we'll do more on this. Excellent. You'll come at the top of the hour. Thanks to the crew in New York again, and thanks, Steve, for being with us.
Sure.
This has been another hour of the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, and next week we'll come back and talk more about this incredible issue of election theft and how we're really going to manage it. The question, Pete, Steve, to run out, is anybody talking seriously about paper ballots? I mean, is it even an issue anywhere?
No. The short answer is no.
All right. Even if we legalize hemp and print the ballots on hemp paper, they're not going to do it, huh?
The people in these systems and these bureaucracies move way, way too slow, and the money is not on the pipeline. It's not going to be on the pipeline. You know, nobody's about to go out there with new, like, iPads and PC pads and come up with, do it all.
All right, buddy. We'll talk next week. Thank you to the crew in New York, and we'll see you next week in Solartopia.
Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.